This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Maybe you've heard that climate change can be a threat multiplier. Now you are talking Sherry Goodman's language because she coined that term as her group of military experts assessed the national security risks of a shifting climate. Longtime listener and author Guy Murphy suggested Goodman as a guest. Sherry is just back from a speaking tour in Australia. It turns out Radio EcoShock guest and author of Climate Code Red, David Spratt, helped organize that tour. Sherry Goodman has worked in the Pentagon. She was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security. From 2001 to 2015, she was Senior Vice President and General Counsel for a nonprofit group called CNA. CNA is the parent of CNA Institute for Public Research and the CNA Center for Naval Analysis. That group received federal funding to advise the United States Navy and the Marine Corps. Sherry Goodman founded and directed the CNA Military Advisory Board, and that's important because it produced two key reports on climate and security. Let's get to the big picture. Sherry Goodman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, right now, in the Middle East, it's turmoil, and across Saharan Africa, governments have failed. Millions of refugees are moving north towards security. That hasn't stopped. There were like 5,000 a couple of days ago. Where is the climate change in that picture?
Well, the climate that's been changing is the long-term drought that underlies these conflicts. Syria experienced a long-term drought leading into the 2011 uprisings and civil war, and that underlies the instability in that country. Similarly, throughout the Arab world, in Egypt and in Tunisia, the Arab Spring uprisings were in part sparked by a prolonged drought that occurred in parts of Russia and Ukraine, China, all wheat-producing regions. In fact, Russia stopped exporting wheat in the months leading up to the Arab Spring uprisings, and it was the food insecurity, the lack of wheat to produce bread in those countries, that was the spark that lit the match there in that region.
And I would say anyone who looks into the science behind rising seas knows that the densely populated lowlands of Bangladesh are a disaster waiting to happen. But I did not know until I looked into your work that India has already built a security perimeter against climate refugees from Bangladesh. What do you know about that?
Well, it's the longest and most heavily armed, some call it climate refugee fence in the world, fencing Bangladesh on three sides, designed to keep Bangladeshis from fleeing across the border into India. As you've said, Alex, it's a very low-lying region in much of Bangladesh on the very low coastline, heavily populated in an area where rising seas, storm surge, an extreme weather event could send millions of Bangladeshis fleeing north for their safety towards the Indian border.
So why, Sherry, did you go to Australia and how did it go?
Well, I went to Australia to carry forward this conversation we've been having the last decade here in the United States and elsewhere about climate change as a national security challenge, a threat multiplier, if you will, for instability. And we see this happening increasingly, affecting our troops where they deploy, affecting our ability to respond to increasing intensity of storms, extreme weather events. And in Australia, their dynamics are in some ways similar to ours, where increasingly, the country is threatened by increasingly extreme weather events. They had just had a cyclone that affected the Great Barrier Reef area, caused extensive damage and several tragedies. And they've also had prolonged drought. It's the driest continent on the planet, but it's been suffering even a more extreme drought. And like our own country, it also has extensive fossil resources, which it has exploited over many years, and now is coming to grips with how to affect the right balance between its energy and its climate objectives. And so we had this conversation in some of the key cities in Australia, in Sydney, in Canberra, the capital, and in Melbourne with a great variety of leaders across civil society, the military, business, public policy, and elsewhere. And I would say that there is quite an awareness of the challenges that Australia faces from climate change in the Asia-Pacific region. You know, Australia finds itself in what I characterized as disaster alley, because in the Asia-Pacific region, they already were the home to many extreme weather events, but they've been seeing more frequent intense weather events over the last decade as a result, most likely, of the warmer Pacific Ocean temperatures that fuel those storms. And so Australia is one of the key countries affected by all the intensity, both of the storms and the heavily populated, densely populated urban areas across the Asia Pacific.
Well, looking back a bit in America, I know that the administration headed by George W. Bush was not all that active on climate. What was the military thinking at the time prior to your 2007 report?
Well, you know, the thinking within the U.S. Department of Defense on climate change actually dates back several decades, and much of it began actually under the first George Bush administration, continued during the time when I was served in the 90s as in the Pentagon, was during the era where the U.S. was participating in the Kyoto Protocol negotiations, and so we began to consider how greenhouse gas emissions would apply to military operations. And then that work continued without as much visibility, but at some practical levels within planning circles within the military, and got a lot more attention within the last decade when our report was released from the CNA Military Advisory Board, National Security and the Threat to Climate Change. The Defense Department was directed by Congress the next year to include the national security implications of climate change into all its major planning documents. And the National Intelligence Council was also directed by Congress to assess the national intelligence implications of climate change in its intelligence estimates. And that led, since 2007 and 2008, to really a decade's worth of very productive work within the military and intelligence communities to understand the strategic, operational, and tactical implications of climate change at all levels of command and in all its various complexities.
So what are the major developments in the updated 2014 report, National Security and the Accelerating Risks of Climate Change?
Well, in that 2014 report, we found that risks of the climate change are continuing to accelerate, that they are now a catalyst for conflict, and that one of the great concerns we identified is sort of a failure of imagination to think about how climate change could produce unexpected events, incidents, substantial risks globally in coming years. And, you know, we've often been surprised, unfortunately, as a nation, from Pearl Harbor to 9/11, history shifts in ways that are unexpected. And what we become good at is preparing to fight the last war. So I think it's hard for us to imagine exactly how climate change could become an even more substantial risk than it is today, than the gradual risk, the ones with the severe storms. But we know that the risks are continuing to mount as we see the records, the ice melting in the Arctic at a rate more rapidly than even scientists have predicted, and faster than anywhere else on the planet, so that we now have a whole new ocean that's been created in that region, and one where we'll see a whole new set of geopolitics emerging in coming years, opportunities and risks in that region, just as an example of ways in which we have to use our imagination and good planning to understand those opportunities and risks.
Well, you know, Sherry, I'm pretty sure many of my listeners assume the first climate tragedy will hit countries far away, but has the military looked at what might happen if, say, the California drought had continued for decades or longer, or if we get a string of major hurricane hits like Katrina and Sandy all together?
Well, that's what they are beginning to do now, and I think that's very important, because we need to be prepared not only for one event, but for several events, a cascading set of events potentially to occur. A prolonged drought in the West has produced an unprecedented number of wildfires, begun really to change the whole character of our Western United States. And at the same time, in the east, we see increasing number of storm events along the Atlantic coast, rising sea levels, very vulnerable regions. Our military at Norfolk Hampton Roads, which is the largest naval complex in the United States, already experiences sunny day flooding, where it floods regularly even on sunny days, and sometimes people can't get onto the base to get to work because the roads already washed out. And these challenges are only mounting. So now the military in those communities is working to reduce those risks, whether it's building higher seawalls or working to relocate infrastructure and working with the communities. And this is what I think we're going to need to do across the nation, which is look at how we build more resilient communities. And as we look at rebuilding our infrastructure in this country, whether it's roads, rails, bridges, water, electrical, other energy infrastructure, we need to ensure that it accounts for climate change and is climate smart infrastructure that enables us to be resilient in the coming years.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and my guest is lawyer and military advisor Sherry Goodman. We are talking about climate change as a threat multiplier. I find it interesting your CNA Military Advisory Board released a report in 2015 on the national security grid. Why?
Well, because the grid itself is vulnerable to both deliberate attack and to natural disasters. You know, we've experienced that in recent years, where intense storms have produced prolonged power outages. We know that it's vulnerable to cyber and other types of deliberate attack. And, you know, the military itself is, since many military bases, you know, operate off the national grid, that's a risk that the military has to protect itself against, too. So we began to look at how to reinforce a vulnerable electrical grid and how we can make our nation more secure and improve our military operations and our military performance by changing the way we think about the grid. And we see that now, that we're in the middle now of a transformation of our whole electric grid, moving towards more distributed and smart microgrids, enabling both military bases and cities not to be so dependent on one single point of failure, which is a totally connected grid. And so that's a good move. It, you know, may not occur as fast as we need it to, but, you know, as you see signs of progress across the nation and certainly at our critical military installations.
Well, we just had a recent expert on the show explain that either solar storms or a hostile nuclear blast in the upper atmosphere could crash that grid and most of the electronics behind our civilization. Sherry Goodman, do you think that's a genuine worry?
Well, I think that's one of those low probability, high consequence events that we have to prepare for. I've often said that I can't compare climate risk with the risk that we face in the Cold War of a bolt out of the blue nuclear attack from the Soviet Union, where we spent billions of dollars of U.S. GDP to deter and prevent that threat of a nuclear attack. And we were fortunate. We won that war. Of course, we still face the risk of nuclear threats, and we continue to be vigilant in identifying and addressing them. With climate change, you know, we arguably face a higher probability risk, one that has equally high, if not higher, consequences for civilization. But it's one that's harder to mobilize both our nation and indeed many societies to fully address.
So when it comes to climate change outside of America, have you had much interaction or feedback from the military in other countries? What are they thinking? What can you share with us?
Well, many militaries now, Alex, include climate change within their military planning activities, particularly across Europe and in other nations as well. So we see a lot of good thinking, planning, dialogue going on. The next step really is to sort of integrate this kind of thinking at the both the operational level and throughout society, and that requires sort of making hard choices about investments and looking across the range of risks. But we see, you know, a lot of good signs that thinking is occurring in the right way, and that particularly military educational institutions in many key countries from Latin America to Africa, Asia, and across Europe are beginning to understand those risks.
So how could the military help prepare civil society for the rude shocks that accompany a shift in climate?
Well, I think first, the military, like any organization, needs to understand the risks to itself. So for the U.S. military, looks at the risks both to bases, as we talked about, for example, sea level rise or drought effect, and heat, for example, affects the health of our troops, both when they deploy and when they train at bases that increasingly are experiencing red flag days, temperatures consistently over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which make it a risk for troops to train for too long. So understanding risk to bases, to health, and understanding other risks, that's sort of the place one should start first, and then sharing that information with civil society and with communities. So where are bases like it at Hampton Roads in Norfolk are working with the towns around them because they're all experiencing those same risks. And then sharing that information across militaries and sharing it in broader civilian contexts and in civil society, I think is very important.
Well, now here's a deep problem. Give me a minute here on this one. Democracies, have failed to rein in greenhouse gas emissions so far. It's possible we may enter a time of repeated shocks to the system, a kind of long emergency, as Jim Kunstler called it. And maybe only the military can operate in that environment. Certainly the armed forces will be called in time and time again. And that leads to a tough question for my listeners and for all of us. If the only organization still functioning is the military, and we need some level of decision and action to save what remains of the climate, would we accept a military government? Under those extreme terms, would you, Sherry?
Well, that's not the premise on which our nation was founded, and we function very well with civilian control of the military. I think even in the current administration, while few would have predicted exactly the government we have today and its particulars of leadership, I think that there are many who remark on how well it's the military is currently being led today. I myself have great regard for Secretary Mattis and for the leadership that he and others are providing. And so I think that they're doing that in the context of now civilian leadership. And I think we train our military very well in this country so that they're amply prepared to take on a lot of leadership roles. But I think that thinking clearly about the appropriate allocation of responsibilities as between civilian and military leadership is sort of a core principle on which our democracy is founded.
I wonder how long we have left to organize rational action to save the climate that we need to survive before we're just sort of responding to emergencies and being buffeted by the climate change. What is your thinking along those lines?
I'm optimistic that, we are going to move as a society in the right direction, that as we look to make our communities, and what we've seen over the last decade is that a lot of leadership on climate change and on energy and water issues is at the local level. It's at the state and local level. And I think that will continue to be the case. And we've seen a lot more interesting activity at not just at the state and local level, but what people now refer to as the subnational level, where states might be working with other, let's say, a Canadian province or another state province in another country. And we've seen this exchange both of information sharing about problems, opportunities, and risks. So we see in this network world in which we live that not everything is top down anymore. There's a lot of opportunities to network across different levels and horizontal, vertical, networked, if you will, in the sort of spider web of both risks and opportunities we live. So I'm hopeful that this network world enables us to deal with the complexity of the climate and other challenges we face in a way that allows us to harness the innovation, the technology, and the adaptability that we need to thrive into the future.
I'm trying to assess where the public is when it comes to climate change and where the military is. Do you think one is ahead of the other, or are we all in this general confusion of a situation that we've never seen before in human history?
Well, look, we all face unknowns because every day we're writing the next phase of our individual and our national history. I think that the military as a planning organization has the benefit of regularly trying to peer into the future and understand what new risks are on the horizon and then bringing that learning back into it. It's not the only learning organization. I mean, many great companies, many great universities, and other organizations all function as learning organizations. And I think that that is foundational, indeed fundamental, in the time in which we live, to be able to understand these new risks, adapt to them, and set our societies on a more resilient course.
Looking back in your life so far, what do you think led you into this unusual conjunction of climate and security?
Well, I have sometimes said that my career has gone from weapons to waste. I wanted, in the early part of my career, indeed always, I wanted to work on the challenges that were most important to our nation and to our society. And in the Cold War, the nuclear age, that risk and that threat seemed to be nuclear weapons and the arms control and other measures we would use by which to manage those risks. And so that's where I began my early career. I wrote a book. My first book was on the neutron bomb controversy and a case study in alliance politics. And I looked at the technology of nuclear weapons and it applied to managing the NATO alliance during the 1970s and the 1980s. I then went on to serve as the first female professional staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee during a time when the nation's nuclear weapons complex, the nuclear plants across our country at Hanford, Savannah River, Rocky Flats, and elsewhere, shut down for environment safety and health lapses during that period. And so as the committee and began to address those issues, take testimony, conduct hearings on those issues, we got into a range of environmental questions applying to both the Department of Energy, Department of Defense facilities. I practiced environmental law for a number of years and then moved in at the Defense Department when I went to the Pentagon to essentially being the chief environment safety and health officer for the nation's largest industrial organization. So since that time, I've had the privilege of working very closely with our nation's military, for whom I have deep and abiding respect. And during that era, we went from the military went from being seen in the early 1990s as an environmental laggard of sorts because there were many Superfund sites and other bases that had to be cleaned up as those laws were coming into effect and being applied to federal facilities, to being seen now as an environmental and clean energy leader. And really, the military today is seen as a forward-looking organization in this regard. In the last decade, there have been a lot of great innovations on military energy to address, improve both mission performance, cost savings, and really be at the forefront of taking technological innovations, everything from microgrids for deployed forces to solar and wind for operational and sort of city installation level use. And the military has really both benefited a great deal from that and has also been able to work with private sector and other innovators to advance this new whole new area that's enabling the U.S. to be an energy superpower in a variety of ways.
You must be in a bit of a strange place now. The government you normally advise may not want your advice because they say there is no climate change, or if there is, humans are not the cause of it. Sherry Goodman, how can you proceed now?
Well, you know, our military is still very responsibly addressing these issues. Current Secretary of Defense Mattis has said that climate change poses risks to the stability of our forces where they're operating today, and that this is something that our commanders need to understand and take account for in their planning. And so I think that, you know, this work continues at a practical level, despite the fact that there are disagreements within the current administration about how to proceed on a range of environmental issues. And I'd like to think that common sense will prevail, that American leadership is important in this area as it is in others.
Are there any final thoughts you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, we all have a responsibility to engage in our communities in ways that can make a difference. And this is an area where we need to all understand what the risks are and to help build more resilient societies. And I've been very privileged to work with a group of individuals across our military and in civilian society that really understand these risks but are also helping to build a resilient future, about which I am continue to be optimistic.
Our guest, Sherry Goodman, has literally been in the halls of power advising in the Pentagon and then later with a nonprofit that helps develop military planning. Sherry is a senior fellow at the Wilson Center, and you can find links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Sherry Goodman, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.